All right, it's my intention today to finish the book of Esther. This is part six of our study, and although it is a mammoth task to complete these chapters, I felt like in reading it that we could do it. We were up to the task because we had laid the foundation. And it is also my own personal desire to finish Esther. It has been a most difficult study for me. It's been a personal struggle and battle when I started opening the book of Esther to see what it contained. I was afraid that it might be more than I could bear. And it has been from week to week. In learning the lessons that are in this book, and I have by no means plumbed the depths of it. And there may be many things that you've thought of that I haven't touched on. And I encourage you to read the book again. It is the Word of God, and it never does exhaust itself in our study. And so I encourage you to continue to read the book of Esther and find the things in it that I have not seen or that I have not been able to share. But as we look at chapter 7, we're going to conclude this drama that we've been studying. And I think one of the things that has been the most difficult for me is to realize the consequences of sin. I think even as believers, when we've been saved by grace, redeemed, we sometimes forget the heinousness of sin. And we sometimes forget that the law of consequences has not been obliterated. That there are consequences even in forgiveness that we must bear. And as I said to the ladies in the jail this morning, there are two irrevocable laws of sin. We reap what we sow, and we reap to the whirlwind. And oftentimes we do not intend to bring the harm that we bring to those around us, but we do. And I think this book, if nothing else, brings our attention to the consequences of sin. If for nothing else, Esther and Mordecai were in captivity because of sin. Not their particular sin, but the sin of the generations before who had been warned and they had not heeded the warning. And in our haste to do our pleasure, we create for generations beyond us the consequences of our decisions. And I think as a parent, as a wife, I have again become more aware of what my decisions will cost. And I encourage those of you whose children are not grown, I can assure you that this is the time to lay the foundation, because you don't have this time to come again. This is all you have, and you will live with what you sow. But now, if we've been studying the book of Esther as we would study just any short story, we have some... I used to teach literature, and we have various elements of a short story. We have the introduction, and then we have that rising action that we get as the plot builds and thickens to the climax. And then at the climax, we begin to have the falling action until we get to the closing. And in this particular story, we're introduced to Esther as the protagonist, the good person, a good character, and Haman as the antagonist. And we're meeting them as they meet each other face to face for the first time. Esther knew that Haman was the enemy, but poor old Haman, he still thought he was in the most favored status. As chapter 7 opens for the banquet. And just as Esther had promised the day before, she had prepared that second banquet for both the king and Haman. And the first verse of chapter 7 confirms that the king's chamberlains, as we close chapter 6, and they had come to Haman's house, they had indeed taken Haman to the banquet, where we find that he and the king are drinking wine with Esther at the party. Now, it's probable that by the time of this second banquet, the king's curiosity to know the reason for Esther's banquets is to be about more than he can bear. Because he asked her for the third time to tell him her request, again promising to grant her her request even to the half of his kingdom. And this has to be a most interesting scene. The king was certainly savvy enough to know that Esther hadn't risked her life just to invite him to have a banquet. And the fact that she was prolonging her request didn't escape the king either. Ahasuerus was well aware of his power and the position in his own kingdom. He would have been approached with the same care and caution by anyone in his kingdom who would have been close enough to have made a request of him. So he wasn't ignorant for the reason of Esther's caution, and he was probably self-assured that she could request nothing of him that would cause him surprise. But Haman, on the other hand, had spent an agitating morning. And now he was sitting blissfully sipping wine with the king and queen. In his mind, he had been included, of course, because he was Haman. Mordecai and that problem, quote unquote, would be on his business agenda the very next time that he met privately with the king. But disposing of Mordecai would be just so much paperwork. So Haman here at the party was a perfect picture of that old saying, ignorance is bliss. But this bliss was to be short-lived because the king had insisted on knowing Esther's business, and much to Haman's chagrin, she was ready to divulge the whole matter in a very forthright manner. And we find there in chapter 7, and verse 3 and 4, she turns to the king, and she says, if I have found favor in your sight, which she knew that she had done because he had come to the second banquet, then she explained the crisis that motivated her great risk in approaching the king, and she did so by quoting the very words of Haman's new law. For, she said, we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. She doesn't even begin by explaining to the king that the king himself had just signed a petition that would destroy all the Jews and would destroy his new queen also. He wasn't in any need of being informed about petitions that he had just signed. But granted, he truly may have given the whole affair so little thought that he had even forgotten about it. But Esther wasn't going to risk any insult on his character by insinuating that he could possibly have signed an edict without remembering it or having understood its ramifications. But the reason for Esther's bold approach to his throne was no longer a secret. She explained to the king that she would not have troubled him, and this is interesting, she would not have troubled him at all if she and her people only had been sold as slaves. Although slavery would not have been a wise choice for the king if his intentions had been to dispose of the Jews, she would still have refrained from petitioning him. Rather, she and her people would have accepted bondage because there was the hope of the possibility of one day being released. And besides, the king would have still had the economic benefits from the Jews, even if they were in slavery. But to destroy an entire nation, as she pointed out, would cost the king far more than the price the king had been paid by the enemy. Esther may not have known that Haman was to pay precisely 10,000 talents, But she did know that he was to pay an enormous amount, and it was enough to have satisfied the king at that time. And since she had already risked her life, she boldly named this to him. And she named the instigator, although she hadn't yet called his name, she named him the enemy. So the destruction of a whole nation and the loss of productivity and the revenue had not been a serious consideration as it should have been with King Ahasuerus. Perhaps he was beginning to realize that this enemy was more interested in satisfying some personal grudge at a very great expense to the king. But worse still was to learn that this enemy had caused the king to sign a proclamation that would destroy his new queen. So the next question of the king's was obvious. The king said in verse 5, "Who is he? And where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so?" In other words, who did this? And Esther wasn't shy when she answered that question. She answered it, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." Now, we can only imagine the look on Haman's face. How could he have expected such a declaration from the queen, who had just invited him, and him only, to not one but two banquets? Everything was going his way. Even the last problem of Mordecai had a final resolution already built. So what had happened? Haman must have realized immediately by that bold accusation of Esther that things were not going to go well for him. And he was terrified, the Bible says, before the king and queen. But Ahasuerus was angry. All these bits of information had come together to paint a picture that was very displeasing to the king. He got up from the table and went out into the palace garden, no doubt to gain control of himself. And Haman must have been completely overcome with fear as he realized that the king had not taken his side. Both men must have been shocked at such a bold and emphatic proclamation by Esther that Haman was the enemy and not the Jews. What a horrid surprise for Haman to find out that Esther was the same nationality as that awful enemy Mordecai. He was instantly aware that he must appeal to Esther if he had any hope of surviving the anger of Ahasuerus. The king had gone out, and so Haman got up from his couch and he fell on his knees at the couch of Esther. Now, it's probable that he fell on his knees at the foot of the couch or to the side of the couch on which she was reclined to eat. And he was completely overcome with emotion, so he began to appeal to her to spare his life. Now, the king had manifested unusual patience and accommodation with Esther, but he wasn't going to do the same for Haman. Just as had been said before, promotion under such a king as Ahasuerus was living in a very risky world for Haman. It would only take a whim of this king to accomplish Haman's downfall. And sadly for Haman, the king's anger had erased his memory of Haman's rank and standing. He must have conjured up the worst possible conception of Haman, because as the king stepped back into the room from the garden and he saw Haman on his knees at Esther's couch, he made the basest of accusations against Haman. He said, "Will he force the queen also before me in the house?" Now, Haman had certainly fallen completely out of favor in such a moment, and no accusation that the king could make against him would seem too far-fetched. And this seemed moving rapidly. Probably in less than 10 minutes, Haman was ruined. But the king had just realized that the man who had occupied the seat next only to his own had deceived him into signing on to such a monstrous scheme as to exterminate this prosperous and productive nation of people and to deprive him of this pleasing queen as well. So, of course, there in front of guards and attendants, Haman would have been insane to have attempted anything against the queen. He was a man overcome with distress. But as the king was speaking, some attendants there in the room covered Haman's head so the king could not see his face anymore. And the covering of Haman's face verified that the king had passed the death sentence on him. Haman's complete fall was probably accomplished in less time than it had taken him just 2 or 3 months before to roll the dice and find the optimum day to kill all the Jews. Poor Haman. It wasn't too convenient for him that one of the king's chamberlains, possibly the one that had gone to his house to fetch him for the banquet, just happened to know all about the brand new gallows at Haman's house. And this servant, Harbona, was also apprised of the information that the gallows had been built to execute Mordecai, the man whom the king had just honored for saving his life. This must have added to the king's fury to learn that Haman had prepared for execution, not only for which he had not gotten the king's approval, but for a loyal subject who had saved the king's life. And then we see in verse 9 of chapter 7, the king said, "Hang him thereon." And the last verse of chapter 7 seems to be a fitting conclusion. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Now that brings us to chapter 8. Once the climax of the story is reached, then the falling action concludes in the denouement, or it's a French word there that just means the conclusion. It means literally, however, to untie the knot. So as you're at the climax, you've reached this peak of the action. Now you begin, and in Shakespeare, as we used to say, in Act 5, everybody gets killed. That's left standing. There's nobody left standing by the end of Act 5. But you begin to untie that knot until everything is unraveled and everything is explained. And this is where we are in chapter 8. This is the resolution of the story's conflict between the protagonist and the antagonist. For Haman, this knot actually is tightening around his neck, and his part of the script is concluded. But for the protagonist, Esther, the type of ending will define the story as a comedy or a tragedy. Things go well in the end for the protagonist in a comedy, which is precisely what is going to happen for Esther and Mordecai. The chapter division here opens chapter 8, but the banquet has not yet ended. Haman has been removed from the king's sight, and he's been hanged on his own gallows. But the king would, of course, become the sole proprietor of Haman's estate, which he promptly bestowed on Esther. And remember, we learned that Persian women could be property owners in their own right. But in the flurry of events, Esther has revealed her relationship to Mordecai, and he's brought in and presented to the king. And then we are told that someone evidently had the presence of mind to strip Haman of the king's signet ring before he was whisked away and returned that to the king, and Ahasuerus took that from his finger and presented it to Mordecai. This was the ring that was used to seal documents, and its presentation to Mordecai meant that he was promoted to the position that was just vacated by Haman. But Esther's petition was not yet complete. She spoke again to the king, according to verse 3, with weeping to stop the mischief that Haman had set in motion against the Jews. But of course, the law of the Persians could not be repealed. The king held out his golden scepter a second time to Esther, and he reminded both Esther and Mordecai that he had just given all of Haman's property to Esther for the very reason that Haman had, in verse 7, laid hands upon the Jews. This evil legacy left by Haman would have to be reversed by the writing of a new law to override the old one. So Ahasuerus instructed Esther and Mordecai to write a law that satisfied them, a law that would reverse the command of Haman's law and then seal it with the king's signet ring. The scribes were called together for a second time to copy down this new law that Mordecai authored. And all the Jews in all the 127 provinces were given the authority to defend themselves and their property against all their enemies. The Jews were given permission to kill any man, woman, or child who assaulted them, and then to take their property as the spoil. So it's reasonable to assume that the Jews had enemies who would avail themselves on the 13th day of the month of Adar to attempt to kill Jews and to confiscate their property. It's reasonable to assume that. But the Jews were given the right of self-defense by force. Now, the commentator Matthew Henry noted the absurdity of this Persian practice of non-revocation. In this particular instance, Ahasuerus, by his own irrevocable edict, was inciting a civil war in his empire. Both sides could take up arms against each other by the king's authority and yet against the king's authority. But copies of Mordecai's law were copied, and they were dispatched with great haste to all the empire as the news spread. The Jews everywhere began to celebrate and feast with great joy, while the fear of the Jews spread among the non-Jewish citizenry, so much so that many became Jews. But meanwhile, back in Shushan, Mordecai is no longer in sackcloth in the king's gate. He's now dressed in royal violet and white with a golden crown going in and out from the audience with the king. We read back in chapter 3 and verse 15 that Haman's law had caused the whole city of Shushan to be perplexed, but Mordecai's law in chapter 8 and verse 15 caused rejoicing in Shushan. This is certainly a reminder, isn't it, of Proverbs 11, 10, and 11? When it goeth well with the righteous, the city rejoiceth. And when the wicked perish, they're shouting. By the blessing of the upright, the city is exalted, but it's overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. And then again in Proverbs 29, 2, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn. Then in chapter 9, as the book is concluding in chapter 9, we're assured that this is indeed a comedy and not a tragedy, because Esther and Mordecai and all the Jews are rejoicing. It is, of course, necessary for the Jews to fight their enemies on the 13th day of Adar. As the fateful day approached, we find recorded in chapter 9 that the fear of the Jews had fallen among the population. As the Jews gathered on the 13th to fight their enemies, the governors of the various provinces gave them assistance because of their fear of Mordecai. This man, according to verse 4, this man Mordecai was powerful. And at the close of this 13th day, the king received the report that 500 men had been killed in Shushan alone, including the 10 sons of Haman. And he asked Esther if she required anything else. And she requested that the city of Shushan be given the next day, the 14th day, to continue the work against their enemies. And then secondly, she asked that the bodies of Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows, and both of her requests were granted. This might seem to be an odd request by the queen, and Esther was criticized by some commentators as being bloodthirsty. But why do you suppose she would have made such a request? Because it was only in the city of Shushan that the fighting was extended for the second day. The Jews in all the other provinces killed 75,000 men on the 13th day. The Jews in Shushan killed 500 men the first day and 300 more men on the second day. Such a large number of slain enemies there in the vicinity of the palace on the first day was a verification to Esther that there were more enemies, that the enemies had been stirred up against them by Haman. And most likely the confederation of his 10 sons, and it was necessary to have a second day. So Esther would have wanted to prevent simply a withdrawal of these enemies at the close of the 13th day, and then for them to sometime later make another assault or a surprising attack. So by allowing this continued defense of the next day, the uprising against the Jews was completely quelled. And by hanging the bodies of the 10 sons on the public gallows, that would underscore any consequences that would be held, that you would face if you came against the Jews at any other time. One commentator considered the permission to extend the defensive posture for this extra day that it was really just an opportunity to expose the enemies of the Jews. And this commentator seemed to believe that those who were killed were mainly the remnants of the Amalekites who were doomed to perish that we spoke of before in Exodus 17:14 and Deuteronomy 25:19. We don't have any indication that every single one of them were Amalekites, but it might not be wrong to suppose that, as this commentator suggested, that some were. But the law of Mordecai, it's interesting, had given permission to kill women and children also, if they were aggressors, and to take all the property. But we find in this chapter that the Jews did not do that. No women and children were killed and no property was taken. So this was proof that the Jews were not aggressors. They weren't motivated by greed and they weren't motivated by revenge. Their sole motivation was self-preservation. And so we find here then in the 14th day, that was a feasting in all the provinces. But the 15th day was the feast day in Shushan. And these were wonderful days of thanksgiving and feasting. And again, Matthew Henry commented concerning a celebration of thanksgiving. He said, when we have received signal mercies from God, we ought to be quick and speedy in making our thankful returns to Him. While the mercy is fresh and the impressions of it are most sensible. And so they did. Esther made a decree that these days were to be celebrated yearly as the celebration called Purim. Mordecai wrote an account of the history of these days and established the observance of the 14th and 15th days, we see in chapter 9 and verse 22, as days of feasting and joy and of sending portions one to another and gifts to the poor. Now, Purim is not a holy day, but the Jewish nation began the observance of Purim during the reign of Esther as a national commemoration of God's divine protection of their people, and they've continually followed that ordinance as Mordecai recorded it to be celebrated in chapter 9 and verse 22. They make it a day of joy and thankfulness for God's deliverance. They make it a day of generosity and giving food to one another, and a day of charity and giving gifts to the poor. There are four main obligations in the modern observance of Purim. If you study it, research it, the first thing they do is they read the entire book of Esther. And they remember God's deliverance and His faithfulness of Esther, the faithfulness of Esther and Mordecai. And then they exchange gifts of food with friends, and then they take charitable gifts to the poor. And then after all of that's done, they have times of feasting and dancing and oftentimes in costumes and masks they wear as part of their celebration. And you might guess that most of the masks are depictions of Haman. The Jews want to remember Haman as one of the enemies who are always seeking their destruction and that they must depend upon God for their salvation. And then we come to the small chapter 10 that concludes this book. It confirms for us that the reign of Ahasuerus and the rule of Mordecai after these events of Purim was prosperous. We're told about the deeds of the king's power and the taxation to the far reaches of the kingdom that were made under the oversight of Mordecai. It's probable that Ahasuerus had never experienced such power and approval among all of his provinces, as he achieved with Esther as queen and Mordecai as his vice regent. Because we see in chapter 10, at the close of chapter 10, we see there that Mordecai sought the wealth of his people, and he was speaking peace to all his seed. And he was known then for care and concern for the welfare and the peace of his people. And that concludes the book of Esther. And as we conclude it, we have the question, what is the application to us? If the Jews continue to remember Esther and to observe Purim even today as a yearly national holiday, then how are we Christians to consider the book to be applicable to us? It is one of the canonical books. Therefore, as Paul wrote to Timothy, it must be profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for instruction in righteousness. So let's take a look. As we've studied through the book, we've considered the faithfulness and the sacrifice of Mordecai and Esther in the circumstances that were ordained for them by God. Now, the scope of this book, of course, for the Jews, is a national one. When considering the continual emergence of their enemies throughout their history, who were bent on their destruction as a nation of Jews. But we're reminded then again in the book of Esther, of God's covenantal care for Israel, as he preserved the remnant of the nation all the way to the fullness of time. Why? When the promised Messiah was born of a woman, just as God had promised in Genesis 3:15. That's what we have to focus on in this book as one of the cardinal lessons. Abraham was promised that the seed would come through his family, and Jacob on his deathbed prophesied to his son that the promised seed would be the Lion of the tribe of Judah, which is confirmed for us in Revelation 5:5. So how could the wicked devices of Haman or any other enemy bent on Israel's destruction be allowed to succeed? A remnant was promised in the covenants that God made, and the remnant would be protected because it was the remnant through whom would come the Messiah, the seed of the woman. Haman could not succeed. And what about Mordecai? While Esther was sequestered, Mordecai had to face Haman every day. He had to hear Haman's proclamation read. He had to make a way for the news to reach Esther, and then he had to wait for her to speak to the king. Yet how much had Mordecai endured already? His daughter had been taken from him. For over 4 years, he had sat daily in the gate just to hear of her welfare, only to be harassed by an Amalekite. Unlike Moses, he had no Aaron and Hur to support him. He bore his trials alone. And the question is, what do we really have left if we no longer have family? What do we really have when those who know us best and love us the most are gone? But Mordecai faced his trial with dignity and carefulness that honored his God. And Haman is also an interesting consideration. When Haman stepped out onto the stage, we were instantly made to understand the providential removal of Vashti and the replacement of her with Esther in such a strategic position. And again, we think of chapter 4 and verse 14, we realize, as Mordecai did when he said to her, that she was crowned for such a time as this. Perhaps as the enemy, Haman should be the focal point of this book. Haman was angry. His attention was diverted from all the greatness and power that was his. He had it all, but it wasn't enough. He would disturb the peace and tranquility of his own home and the homes of the entire nation to instigate a civil war just to achieve the trifle of one man's recognition. Why? Why had he wanted Mordecai to bow? That wasn't even important. For Haman, the fact that he wanted it was reason enough. And he kept company only with those who wanted him to have what he wanted. And he was willing to risk everything. When we think of this hard-headed pride of Haman, we're reminded of what our Lord asked in Mark 8:36. For what shall it gain? What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Haman was overcome by discontent and wounded pride, so much so that he acted foolishly and hastily in pursuing his own agenda. And this is the inevitable outcome that would be his own demise in his own scheme. But he's just one example of someone blinded by pursuit. To Haman, there's no consequences so horrendous in his thinking which should prevent him from having his desires. That was what Mother Eve thought. But she found that the price she had to pay was far greater than she could have imagined as she cradled the battered, lifeless head of her murdered son and wept over the exile of the son who had murdered. David thought that Bathsheba must be his. But the cost was overwhelming. A dead baby, a ravished daughter, a murdered son, a usurper of his throne, all within his family. Even after his death, it was necessary to execute another one of his sons. Where would it end? 14 generations later, it ended in the eventual demise and destruction of the entire kingdom of Israel. Only David's throne was spared as the throne of the promised Messiah. All that David had conquered and built was leveled by Babylon. And this is something you have to think about. Judah was taken back to Babylon. That's the place where Abraham had started when he was called out of pagan idolatry. Oh, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. David's mourning and repentance came from the heart of a believer. But the wicked Haman fell from his throne, prostrated at the feet of the one whom he had attempted to destroy. Yet both men bore the consequences of their sin. So our lesson here is clear. Just like David wanting Bathsheba, and Ahab wanting Naboth's vineyard, and Haman wanting Mordecai's obeisance, the thing that we must have will have a cost far greater than we're prepared to bear. We may be foolish enough to think ourselves exempt from such a tragedy while we continue to build our house of cards, but if we have ears to hear, we must shake ourselves and remember the lofty heights from where Haman fell. One bright morning, he was the vice-regent of the mighty king of Persia. That afternoon he was sipping wine with the queen of Persia, and early that evening he was swinging from a rope, polluting the virgin gallows of his own design. But sadly, he took down with him all of his family. His sons, the strength of his manhood, were killed, and in death they were maligned publicly. Their families and Haman's own wife were left destitute and oppressed by his fallen reputation. Anyone and everyone connected with Haman went down with him. Haman's intentions were always focused on himself. His motivations and his schemes were for self-promotion and self-aggrandizement. And as his family learned, connections with that sort of person always spells disaster. To ride the wave with him always results in drowning in his wake. But if we leave him in the context of the book of Esther, we can still worship God for turning Haman's plot on his own head. But Haman wasn't just a common, ordinary enemy who arrived on the scene to be a menace to Mordecai and ended up harassing the entire Jewish nation. No, no, no. He was one of the last, as we recall, remaining representatives of the family and the nation of Amalek, the time-worn and bitter enemies of Israel. And as we considered earlier, the Amalekites were probably descended from Esau's son, Amalek, as we find in Genesis 36:12. And as we recall, this nation attacked Israel at a particularly vulnerable time for Israel in their wilderness sojourn. In Exodus 17, Israel was thirsty again. And true to their complaining nature, they chided Moses at Rephidim because there was no water. Now, this was the first time that God provided water from a rock for Israel. And after their thirst was quenched, the Amalekites came out against Israel. This was the battle, you remember, in which Aaron and Ur held up the arms of Moses all day until the evening, at which time Israel prevailed. Moses was instructed by God then to record the events of that day in a book and to explain them all to Joshua, because the Lord told Moses he would completely blot out all remembrance of Amalek because of what they had done at Rephidim. And then you remember in 1 Samuel 15, Saul was ordered to fulfill this oath of the Lord when he was told by Samuel to utterly destroy all they have and spare them not. But Saul's kingdom was taken from him by his disobedience to this commandment of the Lord. And we know that Saul not only kept Agag the king alive, but he allowed Amalekites to escape, because we find in 1 Samuel 30 that these Amalekites who escaped and their children destroyed Ziklag while David and his men were away. And David and his army then had to pursue the Amalekites and destroy their city and reclaim the captives. But then still some must have escaped, because we read again in 1 Chronicles 4 and 43 that in the days of King Hezekiah, the last of the Amalekites were killed. But then here in the book of Esther, we meet Haman, the Amalekite. True to his heritage, he was consumed with the total destruction of Mordecai and all Mordecai's people. He would have destroyed all possibility of Israel being propagated as a nation if he had been left to his own purposes. And in such a destruction, he would have destroyed the promise of the Redeemer, the seed of the woman not yet come into the world. But God's covenant would not allow that. Instead, it was a woman who destroyed the remaining Amalekites, as God had promised would be done, thus ensuring the fulfillment of the promise of God that the Messiah would be born of a woman in the fullness of time. We can bless God for his faithfulness. The race of Adam are all sinners, but the seed of the woman, not of Adam, was promised to come as the one who would redeem his people. How many times did the enemy of our souls attempt the destruction of the Messiah? Yet God's word is certain and sure. He promised in Isaiah 9:6 the Messiah's birth, for unto us a child is born, and to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Esther and Mordecai and their people were not in Judah, and they were not in Jerusalem, where they should have been, because of the consequences of sin. They were the generations visited by the sins of their fathers. Yet, We can bless our God that in Esther we find once again his providential provision. There was Esther at her banquet, seated between the two most powerful men in the known world, not knowing if the king would be the enemy, yet facing Haman, who was her certain enemy. And the worship of her God was the line of demarcation in her own household. What did our Lord say? A man's foes shall be they of his own household. But in such a trial, Esther accomplished what was not done at Rephidim by Moses, or by Saul, or by David, or even by Hezekiah. Once again, God used a woman to thwart the purposes aligned against the seed of the woman. And that promised seed is Christ our King, who will deliver us from our enemies because of his love for us. How much better is he than the type we've seen in Ahasuerus, who exerted no personal effort to protect the people of his kingdom? Rather, he was a party to the very folly designed to turn productivity into chaos and civil war. But how much better is our King, who gave himself for us and now intercedes for us at the right hand of the Father? How much better is our King, who turns chaos and despair into productivity and peace? But the Amalekites are also plagues to us, bitter enemies as they were to Israel, if we consider them to be representative of all manner of sin that dwells within us and harasses us continually. Mr. Bunyan understood this well when he described these indwelling sins as Diabolonians who hid in the walls of man's soul and skulked about in the shadows of the town. And even though the true townspeople were to be diligent to hunt them out and destroy these nasty Diabolonians, it was a duty that would not be completed in this world. And he explained, Emmanuel explained, "Now do you know why I have and still do allow Diabolonians to live in your town? It is to keep you awake, to keep you paying attention, to test your love, to keep you watchful, and to cause you to cherish my noble captains and their men and my mercy. My plan is not that they drive you away from me, but nearer to my Father by teaching you to fight, by causing you to want to petition, and to make you little in your own eyes." Are we living in the days of Haman? Is it difficult to understand why things are as they are? Are we perplexed like Shushan was perplexed when Haman's law was announced? Paul told us in Ephesians 6:12 that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And just as the Jews of Esther's day, we too may lament, as they did in Isaiah, that judgment is turned away backwards and justice standeth afar off, for truth is fallen in the street and equity cannot enter. But as believers, we need not face this in such despair. Then how can we hope? We can hope as Isaiah. He said in Isaiah 59 and verse 16, "There was no man, and he wondered that there was no intercessors." There was no intercessor, but we know, we have hope. There's a man, the Son of God, who was redeemed for us, who redeemed us, his people, and who is the truth and the way and the life. We have the blessed hope that weeping may endure for the night, but that joy comes in the morning. The final destruction of the Amalekites would have indeed been a time of rejoicing for the Jews in Queen Esther's day, but how much more will it be a time of rejoicing when we're completely redeemed from our sinfulness, the sinfulness of our flesh, by our covenant God. Until that day, we would do well then to follow the example of faithful Esther and Mordecai as they humbled themselves before God to be used in His kingdom as He worked the great deliverance of His people.